The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Wednesday, the 2nd of April 2008. I'm Andy Duckworth. On today's podcast, is Zimbabwe on the brink of a new era? What's next for Mugabe?
There's clearly pressure coming from within his own party now, as well as international pressure, and of course the pressure of the Zimbabwean people in having voted against him.
Gordon Brown responds to calls to cap the number of people allowed into Britain.
It's a bit like, to my mind, watching Led Zeppelin do a reunion concert at the O2 Arena. You've got all these big beasts of the Thatcherite 80s on this committee, but in their case, instead of Stairway to Heaven being their great number, it's immigration's no good for Britain.
Teachers are to walk out in the first national strike in 21 years. Amnesty tells world leaders staying silent is just endorsing human rights abuses in China.
Right from the top level of activists, human rights workers and journalists, right down to individual petitioners who've got a grievance against the state, people are being harassed, they're being locked up, they're being thrown in prison.
Plus, what can we expect to come out of the NATO summit?
I'd be surprised if Putin didn't say something pretty strong if the Ukraine and Georgia were given, you know, a tremendous welcome and invitation to join, you know, pretty soon.
But first, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Bill Overton.
Pressure is mounting on Robert Mugabe to accept defeat in Zimbabwe's presidential election and step down. Speculation that a deal's been done to arrange his departure has been denied by both the ruling ZANU-PF party and the opposition Movement for Democratic Change. If neither candidate manages to secure more than 50% of the official vote count, there'll be a runoff in 3 weeks' time. More to come from our reporter in Harare later in Guardian Daily. One of Britain's best-known banks, First Direct, has withdrawn from the mortgage market as other lenders increase their borrowing rates and tighten lending rules. The clampdown on mortgages for new customers is likely to contribute to the dipping confidence in Britain's property market. First Direct, which is owned by HSBC, said the decision to temporarily withdraw its mortgages from sale was not a funding issue. Police in Scotland are appealing for information after a human head and hand were found on the beach in Arbroath. Efforts to identify the dead woman will continue today, and police say she doesn't match the records of any local missing person. The grim discovery was made by children playing on the seafront. Local MSP Andrew Welsh said this would be a shock in any area of Scotland, but especially in Arbroath, which is a family holiday town. Scientists at Newcastle University have created Britain's first human-animal hybrid embryo. The controversial technique could be used to investigate debilitating and untreatable conditions such as Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's. The team's success comes days after Gordon Brown was forced to give MPs a free vote on the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Bill. The process has been condemned by Catholic bishops. Manchester United have moved a step closer to the semi-finals of the Champions League. Vital away goals from Wayne Rooney and Cristiano Ronaldo gave United a 2-0 win last night against AS Roma. Barcelona beat Schalke 1-0. Tonight's other quarter-finals see Chelsea take on Fenerbahce, and at the Emirates Stadium, Arsenal face Liverpool. Now for a look at today's papers, where endgame is the word being used by The Times and The Independent for their reports on Zimbabwe. Both papers report that Mugabe's 28-year reign looks to be finished. The Telegraph says that schools will be closed for millions of children if teachers follow through on their vow to strike on April the 24th in protest over pay. The Mail splashes with a report on social networking websites such as Bebo and Facebook, which the paper claims put millions of girls at risk from paedophiles and bullies. More than a quarter of children between 8 and 11 are able to bypass age restrictions on the sites, it says. The Express attacks the government again over its stance on immigration, and The Mirror gives most of its front page over to the news that TV presenter Natasha Kaplinsky is pregnant. The back pages are full of praise for Manchester United's win in Rome. Wayne's a Roman conqueror, says The Sun. More breaking news throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The The UN Secretary-General's calling for calm in Zimbabwe. Ban Ki-moon wants transparency as the votes continue to be counted in the presidential election. There were claims and then denials yesterday that Morgan Tsvangirai's opposition held secret talks with Robert Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party about a transfer of power. The Guardian's Chris McGreal's one of the few international journalists inside the country. We asked him about the growing pressure on Mugabe to concede defeat.
Well, there's clearly pressure coming from within his own party now, as well as international pressure, and of course the pressure of the Zimbabwean people in having voted against him. We see some division inside ZANU-PF with elements of it admitting that they probably lost. And the opposition movement for democratic change says it's talking to senior military and intelligence officials about a negotiated transition of power, partly seeking to reassure them that they won't face, that they have a future in Zimbabwe, that they won't face prosecution, there won't be a purge. But it's not clear the extent to which those negotiations reach up to Mugabe himself, whether these officials are talking indirectly on behalf of Mugabe or despite him.
Some results from the parliamentary elections have been announced. I mean, what do they tell us about the possible scale of his defeat in the presidential elections?
Well, not a lot right now. 130 or so seats are in. They're almost evenly divided between the ruling ZANU-PF and the opposition MDC. What is revealing about them is if you tally up the votes, the total votes for each of those parties, ZANU-PF is actually significantly ahead, even though the opposition says that in the presidential race it is picked up well over 50% of the vote. There is a feeling in the opposition that there's a kind of fraud by stealth underway, in which the Electoral Commission, which is state-run, essentially gives the MDC about half of the seats in Parliament and therefore looks as though it's holding a free and fair election, but is quietly padding the ZANU-PF vote so that by constituency, Robert Mugabe ultimately emerges ahead. The problem with that strategy, if that is the strategy that's underway, is that the ballot results were posted at each of the polling stations and ultimately can be compared with the results that the Electoral Commission issues. And that may ultimately have proven to be a fatal mistake by Robert Mugabe and may make it difficult to pull off any kind of fraud.
Is there any appetite among ZANU-PF senior officials and Mugabe's advisers to just do away with, you know, get rid of any pretense of democracy and impose martial law?
Well, there has been in some circles. That certainly was discussed at the Security Cabinet meeting on Sunday night, although it was rejected. And I think that one of the things the opposition has quite smartly done, although it had considered in the run-up to the election mass protests, it has kept people off the streets so as not to give the army the pretext to move in on the grounds of restoring stability. And I think that as the days tick by and things remain calm here, that position becomes harder and harder to justify any kind of military intervention. And certainly as the days tick by, it must be seeping through ZANU-PF that it will be really in the end, in the long term, very difficult to hang on to power in the face of an overwhelming defeat, and that certainly within the army there's a lot of dissent these days. Soldiers are poor, their families aren't properly fed, and there will be no guarantee at all that ordinary soldiers would obey orders to carry out any kind of military takeover.
Chris McGreal speaking to John Dennis. And for more analysis, go to guardian.co.uk/Zimbabwe.
From guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
Teachers in England and Wales are to stage their first national strike in 21 years. Britain's biggest teaching union, the NUT, has announced a walkout on April the 24th. It's in a dispute over pay. They want a 10% increase, the government's offering 2.5%. The NUT's General Secretary Steve Sinnott tells us why they're unhappy with what's on offer.
Well, the government have determined that teachers' pay increase for 2008 and beyond would be pay increases below the rate of inflation. And we know the consequences of cutting the real pay of teachers and the living standards of their families.
But this pay award has been recommended by an independent review body, hasn't it? Why wouldn't you accept it?
It's been recommended by them and determined by the government. And for us, we won't accept it because it cuts the standard of living of teachers. And we know the impact it has. It has an impact on the morale of teachers, has an impact on recruitment and retention. Teachers have done relatively well since 1997, and teachers' pay has gone up, and so too have been real improvements in recruitment and retention. But we've now in our fourth year of below inflation pay increases, and we've been saying to the government, please don't do this. And we're promised two further years in the future of below inflation pay increases. We are set to return to the bad old days of recruitment and retention crises, of teachers teaching outside of their curriculum areas as a result of teacher shortages. We want no return to those days, and we're speaking a bit more loudly at the moment.
Do you think that you really have a mandate, though, given that only about one in four of your members actually voted for a strike?
Well, that's not true. The turnout was significantly higher than how you're describing, and the turnout in our ballot matches the tight legislation on industrial action, and so we meet the law, and indeed I think our turnout will be probably in the region or maybe even higher than that which will be determining representatives in local government during the course of May. We have authority in this. We have authority from our members to call this strike action.
Given what you've already said about how teachers have done pretty well since 1997, and given what's being said about the turnout, I accept what you've said, that it's within the law, but it is relatively low nevertheless. Do you think parents are really going to forgive you for disrupting their children's education?
Well, I think you've explained that it's decades since we've ever done something like this previously. And what we do know is that every day's education is precious. But what we've been attempting to do is try and persuade government, and I've met with a variety of people, ministers and the Chancellor, and they're trying to explain our case. So it really is a last resort. And we want to try and get people to listen to what we're saying before we reach or see a return to the boom and bust days that caused so much damage in the past.
What could ministers do for you to call this strike off?
Well, I'd be delighted to go and have a good conversation on these issues with ministers. And we would be looking to ensure that we were protective of teachers' living standards and not suffering cuts in their real terms pay.
The NUT's Steve Sinnott speaking to Matt Wells. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, Boris Johnson ducks another showdown with Ken Livingstone in the race to become London's next mayor. Guardian.co.uk/politics. Owen Gibson looks at whether festivals are too corporate and too samey. That's at MediaGuardian.co.uk. And that's where you'll also find Ofcom's announcement on social networking sites like Facebook, with Bobby Johnson investigating the tribes that are forming online. In today's G2, there's a review of all the April Fool's Day stories and why we need to know how many people Nick Clegg has slept with. Plus, as UBS writes off another £9.6 billion, guardian.co.uk/business asks, whatever happened to Swiss banks? Gordon Brown's insisting British business has benefited very substantially from immigration over the last decade. The Prime Minister's been responding to a report which is sparking a huge debate. A House of Lords committee has rejected the government's argument that today's record level of immigration provides economic advantages. The PM's been speaking about this at his monthly media conference.
Tougher sanctions against people who employ people illegally, far greater policing of the minimum wage and proper conditions for anybody who works in our country. I think we've taken much of the action that the House of Lords committee is suggesting, and that action is already happening and already being put into place.
Alan Travis, The Guardian's Home Affairs editor, joins me now. So, plenty of people having their say on this.
Yes, we've seen both Gordon Brown and business leaders in particular coming out and stressing the economic benefits of immigration to the British economy and criticising the proposal from the peers and also backed by the Conservative Party for a cap on non-European migrants coming to Britain.
So they've raised the issue of a cap, and that's controversial too, isn't it?
Indeed, it's right at the very heart of the Tory Party election strategy, if you like, and will feature strongly in the coming general election over the next 18 months, whether or not there should be a fixed limit on migrants coming into Britain. The difficulty is that when you start looking at who and which migrants it would cover, there are whole groups, whole sections of those who come to Britain who you couldn't possibly apply to. For example, just to run through briefly, Gordon Brown claimed that only up to 20% of migrants would be covered, and that the government's points-based system, which is coming into effect this year, would actually manage the numbers for about 60% of the migrant flow. Those that they couldn't control, and all sides agree this is impossible, is other migrants from other European Union countries, such as we've seen from Poland. That covers about nearly 190,000 people a year coming for short-term work, and accounts for nearly a third of all the migrants that come to Britain. Second after that is 100,000 plus students, which no British government in their right minds would turn away because their tuition fees are financing a key section of higher education in this country. Then you have asylum seekers, and the Tories don't want to go back down that road of being seen to be nasty to asylum seekers. And then you have a fourth major group of those who come to Britain for family reunion purposes. These are mostly people from India, Pakistan, and if you start curbing their numbers, you find yourself in the middle of a big race row. This just leaves skilled workers from outside of Europe. Highly skilled workers, investors, overseas millionaires, nom-doms, they're going to be welcome whichever government's in power because they obviously contribute to the economy. So in actual fact, we're left with just a group of what's called tier two workers, semi-skilled, ordinary skilled workers from outside Europe who come here on work permits currently, and that's about 90,000 people out of the whole inflow. It's relatively small out of the entire, so probably Gordon Brown's right to say it's about one in five, and it shows what a limited instrument a cap would be, and also how narrow, actually, the differences between the two parties are on the issue. Labour say their points-based system would do better to manage the inflow of numbers, refusing or granting work permits in individual cases, as opposed to the Tory policy of a less flexible cap or limit on the numbers.
And politically, this is it's a gift to the Tories at the minute, isn't it?
Well, the Tories and anti-immigration groups like Migration Watch were desperate for a bit of legitimacy for their argument. Nobody respectable had come out and said that their arguments about whether or not immigration was of economic benefit to the country had any credibility at all until this House of Lords Economic Affairs Committee. I mean, it's a bit like, to my mind, watching Led Zeppelin do a reunion concert at the O2 Arena. You've got all these greatest big beasts of the Thatcherite 80s on this committee. You've got Norman Lamont, Nigel Lawson, John Wakeham, John McGregor, four ministers who are in Maggie's cabinet in the 80s. And it's like watching a kind of Thatcherite reunion at work. And together, they've got together and influenced this committee to produce this report. But in their case, instead of Stairway to Heaven being their great number, it's immigration's no good for Britain. And that's what's come out of that report.
Alan Travis, thanks very much. I'm Andy Duckworth. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, Bush and Putin are at loggerheads again. Plus, why Harry Potter's invisibility cloak might not be too far away.
Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
But first, world leaders and Olympic bosses are endorsing human rights abuses in China because they are choosing to stay silent. That's just one of the claims from Amnesty International in a new report. It also says a crackdown on activists shows the situation is getting worse and not better in the run-up to the Summer Games in Beijing. Reports also suggest information controls are now being extended to include text messaging in the city. Steve Ballinger from Amnesty's been speaking to The Guardian.
Well, what we're really noticing in China at the moment is a real clampdown on activism, a clampdown on protesters and on people speaking out about human rights. A lot of us have seen this on the television recently from Tibet, where protesters have been arrested, some of them have been beaten, some may even have been shot, and of course journalists have been locked out of the region. But this is happening in mainland China and in Beijing as well. And what we're seeing is, right from, if you like, the top level of activists, human rights workers and journalists, right down to individual petitioners who've got a grievance against the state, people are being harassed, they're being locked up, they're being thrown in prison. And we feel it's part of an attempt to clamp down on dissent ahead of the Olympics.
You report that the pre-Olympics clean-up, if you like, has also resulted in the detention of thousands of these petitioners in the Beijing area. Tell us about that.
Well, so this is a tradition in China that goes right back to when it was run by an emperor, and that was if you've got a grievance from your local province and you don't get satisfaction, you can take it to Beijing and petition the ruling elite, if you like. And so consequently in Beijing you have thousands of petitioners who have got a grievance that they want to take to the central government in Beijing. What the Chinese authorities don't want, of course, are thousands of people who are unhappy in Beijing at the time of the Olympics. And so what we have noticed in recent months is that more and more of these people are being rounded up, they're being detained, sometimes in secret unofficial prisons, and then they're being shipped back to their home provinces, often thousands of miles away from Beijing, and some of them are then being detained again to keep them out of the way until the Olympics are over, and then perhaps they'll be let go. So it's again another attempt to silence criticism, to make sure everything goes happily and smoothly in August.
Gordon Brown has repeated his insistence this week that Britain won't boycott the Olympics. He'll be there. What further action do you think world leaders should take?
Well, Amnesty International isn't calling for a boycott of the Olympics as well. We want the Olympics to go ahead and to help bring human rights to China. But at the moment, that isn't happening. And that's why world leaders like Gordon Brown have got to really step up to the plate now. Things are getting worse. They're not getting better. And unless more pressure is put on China by the International Olympics Committee, by world leaders like Gordon Brown, things aren't going to get any better. So Gordon Brown needs to speak out publicly about China's appalling human rights record. The information's there, he has got the information, but he needs to voice it.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
George Bush and Russia are falling out again, this time over Ukraine and Georgia. The US president pressing for the two ex-Soviet states to be allowed to join NATO. That's being met with resistance from Moscow and scepticism from European members. All this before the NATO summit in Bucharest has even begun. Richard Norton Taylor is our security affairs editor.
Putin's going to play it, I think, quite a sophisticated way. There is an argument about missile defence and whether the Americans want the Czechs to have a big new radar and the opposed to have interceptors. And the Russians say this is far too close to our border and it could threaten us, and of course actually it couldn't. But they're making an issue of it. I don't blame them necessarily. More interesting, I think, is the whole of the kind of centre of gravity this weekend, or the coming days, I should say, up to the weekend, of NATO. The transatlantic alliance will shift to the kind of east, really, because the summit conference is in Bucharest, the capital of Romania, a Black Sea country, now a NATO country. Three sort of Adriatic countries are going to join NATO almost certainly, or be invited to join NATO. That's Croatia, Albania and Macedonia. And then, of course, there's what the Americans say and what Ukraine and Georgia want, and that is to also to be invited sometime to be a member of NATO. Ukraine and Georgia on the Russian borders, the Russians are feeling, not surprisingly, in my view, sort of a bit, if not generally nervous, peeved by the whole thing.
Might Putin change the tone of his speech or even not turn up at all if Georgia and Ukraine are put on the path to joining the alliance?
Well, I'd be surprised if Putin didn't say something pretty strong if the Ukraine and Georgia were given, you know, a tremendous welcome and invitation to join, you know, pretty soon. I don't think that will happen, actually. Germany and other countries, France too, in a certain sense Britain, are concerned about, not only about the concern about the Russian reaction to Ukraine, sort of lapping on Russia's shore, if you like, in the middle of the, on that sort of western front of Russia, but also Georgia bordering Russia with democratic problems of their own, indeed. And that's what I think NATO will in the end agree. They'll say, okay, maybe one day these countries can join, but don't push it now. Partly for legitimate reasons, actually. Ukraine is, I mean, majority of Ukrainians are, I think, against it, just about, in opinion polls, and also half, more or less, not quite half, actually, but a significant amount of the Ukrainian population is Russian. And there's a bit of demonstrations in Ukraine against Russian membership. Georgia's got other problems, both democratic sort of stability, but also pockets in Georgia, which are pretty sort of insecure. So I think Putin will be able to calm down a bit on that front.
Richard Norton Taylor, and there's more discussion on this in our Guardian Weekly podcast. Next, Einstein once said, if at first the idea is not absurd, then there is no hope for it. Now, one of the most distinguished physicists in the world has scrutinised some of science fiction's most outlandish concepts, such as teleportation and force fields, and is convinced they can become reality. We've been speaking to Professor Michio Kaku of City University in New York.
I like to quote from Arthur C. Clarke. He was famous for saying that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And so I wrote the book, Physics of the Impossible, because so many times predictions are made that certain things are impossible, only to find them becoming possible a decade, a few decades later. Most of what we consider science fiction is a class one impossibility. For example, invisibility, teleportation, ray guns, force fields, even telepathy and psychokinesis. Class two impossibilities are much farther down the line, maybe a century or maybe 1,000 years before we can start to manipulate the power of stars and black holes. Time travel, faster than light wormholes and interdimensional travel. And then class three impossibilities are just downright impossible. They violate all known laws of physics, like perpetual motion machines. Paramount Studios told Gene Roddenberry, the founder of the Star Trek franchise, that landing and taking off on rocket ships was too expensive with special effects. So Roddenberry said, okay, we'll just beam them onto the planet and save a ton of money. Well, we've actually been able to teleport individual particles of light called photons. The world's record was set just a few months ago. We can now teleport photons from one Canary Island to another over a distance of 100 miles. The next leap will be to the space shuttle. And after that, to the moon. We can do that with atoms, too, now. And I suspect that within a decade, the first water molecule will be teleported. And after that, DNA. However, to teleport Captain Kirk, that will have to wait for the 23rd century.
Professor Michio Kaku. And you can hear more of that if you listen to this.
I'm Alok Jha on the latest Science Weekly podcast, Confessions of an Eco-Sinner. Environment and science writer Fred Pearce tells us about his mission to find out where all of our stuff comes from. Also in the show,
any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Michio Kaku explains teleportation and the physics of the impossible. Plus, we get up to speed with the biofuel and embryology debates that have seen scientists and politicians lock horns this week. It's all on the latest Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
And that's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. BST. Producing today, James Webster and Phil Maynard. I'm Andy Duckworth. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.